pleasure to introduce Dr. Roy Hammerly from Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. And it is, he's often our faculty and we so enjoy him and pick his wife Peggy returning, who they both just did dish team at noon. And I hear it was a rather lengthy one. So we're grateful for their service in the dish pit as well. So thank you. And Roy's doing a series on fantasy and religion. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thanks for coming. So our session tonight is a first of a three-part, but each of them are kind of individual. You could, you know, if you miss one or two, you can always kind of follow along with what I'm trying to do. And so, and we're scheduled for an hour and a half, so I might have you stand at some time, or if you get hot or want to get a drink, or we're going to try to open the door. We'll do that. I'm very excited to be back at Holden. It's always a treat for me. It seems like whenever I come here, the world changes for me. And I was thinking when we learned about the topic, unity of love, and I saw some of the other speakers that were going to be talking about ecological issues and things. I thought it'd be fun to look at the lives of C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, and then in the third session talk about them. There's a debate going on right now among scholars about whether they are some of the earliest ecologists or not. And it's interesting because the sorts of concerns they had were concerns long before the ecology movement in the 1960s, and they were very influential on many of the people who started that ecological movement. So I thought, well, I'm going to do some research. I'm going to see if I can answer that question in the third session. But my goal tonight is just to talk about J.R.R. Tolkien. Now, this session, I've been talking with some of you as you walked in, and I find we have a diversity of people in the audience, but a number of people, you might just be wondering, who is Tolkien? I know a little bit about him. I know he wrote The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and those sorts of things, and that there's a movie out in the theaters right now called Tolkien as well, and about his life and about his writings. And so what my goal is to do tonight is to talk about Tolkien's life. I find Tolkien's life utterly fascinating. He never wrote an autobiography. He said at one point, I did write it, it's called The Lord of the Rings, a large fantasy novel. He said, everything I am is in those books. And it's a very interesting comment, so we'll have to unpack that a little bit. But I'm going to dive into talking about Tolkien's life, and this biography is by far the best that's out there, really. It's kind of surprising that there haven't been more biographies about Tolkien because he is such an interesting person. But Humphrey Carpenter actually met Tolkien, worked with Tolkien, edited Tolkien's letters, became a friend of Tolkien's. And so we have some very, very interesting insight, and I highly recommend this very, very readable and insightful book. And one thing Carpenter said to Tolkien, he says, well, if I'm going to do something right about your life, I have to have freedom. I have to be able to say things about you that you may or may not like, but it's just my insight about you. And Tolkien thought that was really funny, and he said, yeah, sure, go ahead, you can do whatever you want. And then when the biography's finished after Tolkien died, so he never got to respond to him. But Tolkien loved that sort of thing. But I'd like to start with a personal story, and it's my story. And I know you all have your own kind of stories that get you interested in certain things. Mine starts when my German immigrant parents came to this, they immigrated to Canada. I was born there in Calgary, Alberta. And then they immigrated to Odessa, Washington, which is not too far from here. Odessa is a small German-Russian community. And I was a German speaker in the house. My first language was German. And so one of the dilemmas I had is that when they sent me off to school, I was at a huge disadvantage. I didn't really know how to speak the language. As a result, I was put into kind of remedial reading classes. I don't know if you remember, if any of you had to endure those sorts of things, or remember when you were, if you're a little bit older like me, that they would split up the class. They would have the smart kids, and then there was me, and a few other kids that were struggling. And we were like, maybe Hispanic kids that were in the community, other kids that just struggled with mental issues, and so I was in with that group. And around fifth grade, my parents were really kind of discouraged with my ability to not be very smart. I couldn't read very well, I couldn't retain, I was struggling in school. And so my parents decided on the recommendation of my fifth grade teacher that I should get a tutor. And I had no idea what the tutor was going to be. So down the street from us, there happened to be an elderly teacher that lived in my hometown. Odessa's about 1,000 people, so not a lot of tutors hanging around. And they decided to take me to Mrs. Knorr. I'm pretty sure she was probably in her 80s, but I thought if she was a day under 100, I would have been surprised. She was a wispy little woman, tiny willowy arms, could barely walk, had a real twinkle in her eye, maybe weighed 80 pounds, I don't know. She was just tiny. And when I went into the house for the first time, my impression was, okay, I thought this woman who met me at the door, who was in her 70s, must be her, but it was her daughter. and then they ushered me into this back bedroom. And in that back bedroom was where I was going to learn how to read and really, get tutored. So at first, she's watching a television show. You might remember it, Password. Remember that? And you'd say a word, and you'd have to have the other person guess what the word was. And she said, I thought she was going to force me to read. She said, no, let's watch television. I thought, well, maybe this isn't so bad. And then she was really tricky. She would say, well, what would you say when the word comes up, you have to say it quicker than those people. What would you say? And so we got into this sort of relationship. And then we started reading books. And she quickly discovered that I really couldn't read very well. I had very little comprehension. And then she started introducing me to all the great sorts of classic literatures. But one of the great books that she gave me was Mrs. Pickerel Goes to Mars. It was about an elderly woman who has adventures. And it was clearly about her, right? I thought, this is the woman that I'm talking to. And so for 2 years, she lit a fire in me. She taught me how to read, how to be passionate in that. And then one day I was told that she was obviously not good. She was very ill of health and that she was going to die. And so I had to go visit her. And I said, I don't want to go. If you go to visit dead people that are dying, you might catch that. I didn't want that. I was a stupid seventh grader, But my parents forced me to go because she asked about me. I was probably her world for, because she was locked up in the bedroom. And so she got, I'm sure, some joy from me being there. And so I went into her and, I kind of said, I hope you're okay. And she said, no, I'm not. I'm going to be dying soon, but it's really nice to see you. And she said, just have a present for you. Just want you to take this. So I took the book that she gave me, and I just, I remember having a pleasant conversation, but nothing much else sticks from that conversation other than kind of the smell of the room, kind of the smell of musty death. And I remember I went home and I threw the book onto the shelf and left it there. I'm not sure how long, but it was probably a year. And I remembered something that she said. She said when she gave me the book, she said, the only thing I want you to do is promise me one thing, that you'll read this book. And I said, okay, I'll do that. I kind of reluctant. You can't say no to somebody who's dying, and then you're making this promise, and you don't know what you're in for, right? And so I said, okay. And then I remember we were going to Europe to visit my grandparents, and my mom said, bring a book along to read. And I saw that book on the shelf, and I thought, probably she's going to curse me, if I don't read that book. So I grabbed it, and I remember very distinctly sitting on the plane, and the plane took off, and we didn't have televisions or little monitors there. So I kind of flipped the book open, and the opening line was, in a hole in the ground, there was a hop. So suddenly I realized that this woman is a wizard, that she had just cast a spell on me that I didn't realize until many years later. I mean, it really doesn't, because Tolkien was a medievalist. He studied medieval studies. He was very interested in religious medieval studies, and I'm a medieval religious scholar. I think the reason I am is partially because of that book. It enchanted me. It created great wonder within me, and I never could let that book go. I read it 3 times in a row during that summer. And then when I came back, I couldn't read The Lord of the Rings fast enough. And then it was like I was off and running. It was like I wanted to read. I couldn't read more. And then I eventually did a PhD in medieval studies from the University of Notre Dame. So this book has the ability, at least for me, and I think sometimes for people who've read it, to change them. But how does it change them, and why does it change them? And those are some of the questions that I'd like to explore as we go through that today. I tell this story to honor Mrs. Knorr because it's been a long time since that happened, but I just want to honor her memory. I love the quote. I'm going to go back to this one real quick to start our session off. The Tolkien, it's a character by the name of Strider in The Lord of the Rings. He's actually incognito when he's saying this thing. He winds up being Aragorn, and he'll become, one of the books, he becomes the king of the land. And when he first meets the hobbits, who are halfling creatures, they're tiny little creatures, we'll find out more about them later. Aragorn gives him this little bit of a warning. He says, all that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. They thought Strider, he's a ranger, and they were kind of wondering. I said, not all who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be the blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king. From that phrase, you probably get an idea that Tolkien was really interested in words. He was really interested in poetry. And we'll find out how that came about. When he described himself, he says, I'm a hobbit. Now, a hobbit's a halfling. They live in little holes in the ground. I'm a hobbit in all but size. He was pretty short, actually, but he was still taller than the hobbit. I like gardens, trees, really important, trees, and unmechanized farmland. He hated what was happening to England with mechanization of farming and cars. I smoke a pipe. I like good plain food. In fact, he hates the French. He hates French food. He hates French, what he thinks is pretty pompous sort of lifestyles. And he says, I go to bed late and I get up late. And I do not travel much. Interesting. Hardly travel in his life at all. And yet, he's probably helped whoever has read his books travel more to lands far unknown. Well, just to say a few things about his life, and I just kind of want to go through, and every now and then I'll take an excursus and I'll go off and talk a little bit about who he is and some of his ideas. One of the things I'm wondering about is Tolkien clearly has this deep, deep passion for the land, for ecology, for sustainability, for farm-to-table sort of living, and this is way back in very early days. And how does he get that, and how did he come to be that sort of person, and how does that come into his writings? He was born to Mabel Suffield and Arthur Rule Tolkien. Interesting. His dad looks like a very, very stern man, doesn't he? And Mabel seems, she was quite loving, quite dear, and quite compassionate. The Tolkien family was known for having a piano business, the Tolkien Piano Company. And everybody in the Tolkien family was very musical, and they loved to enjoy it. But the piano business fell on hard times. And alas, Arthur had to go find another way of making a living. And one of the things that he did is he went into the banking industry. And as he went into the banking industry, England was going through some rough times in the late 19th century in banking, and so he wound up taking a job in South Africa. Now, he was 13 years older than Mabel, and they became engaged at the age of 18. She was 18. He was 31. She was 18. And things were dicey, right? You know, the parents, Mabel's parents, I'm sure were wondering, you're going off to marry this old guy to go to South Africa. It seemed like it must have been halfway around the world. It just seemed unimaginable. But she seems, from what we know about her, very in love with him. And so they go in 1891, and a year later, my daughter, who is a neonatal intensive care nurse, probably would have taken care of John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, the baby, because he was born very prematurely, but he did okay. He was pretty healthy right there anyway after some time. A lot of my photos are from the Tolkien Trust website, and that you can find if you're looking for them. So if they're not marked, that's usually where they're from. So he was born, and he was born into his religious background was, of course, the Church of England. His father was a Church of England, Mabel was a Church of England, and he was baptized in the Church of England. And that'll become important a little later. So they were there, and they have a fairly happy family life. Interesting picture, isn't it? They had servants, African-American servants. So clearly, as a banker, he had some means. And there, the mother and the father are sitting and standing there, and the servant is holding him. And then these are the people that were taking care of the yards and things around him. In fact, the one nurse that's holding him one day did a rather heroic thing. Tolkien was just about, he wasn't two yet. He was walking along, and he tripped, and he fell onto the ground. And when the nurse pulled him up, he had fallen onto a tarantula. And the tarantula bit him. And, of course, tarantulas have poison, and so the nurse sucked the poison out. She immediately knew what to do, and she took care of him. Those of you know the stories of Tolkien's Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and if you just are somewhat familiar with them, would you raise your hand? How many of you could say you know a little bit about them, okay? You know that spiders do not do well with his stories, right? And a lot of people have said that this incident from his childhood is why spiders are usually kind of the villains in his fantasy stories. You remember the Mirkwood story in The Hobbit, where those spiders wrap up all the dwarves and Bilbo, and then, of course, Shelob, the great villain in The Lord of the Rings. A lot of people have pointed to that. But one of the things that his father was, he was absolutely fascinated with trees and loved agriculture and gardening and things like that. And he had some health issues, so South Africa was actually quite good for him when he was living there. Mabel found it kind of difficult, but Mabel also had a passion for gardening and trees, and she knew a lot about them. And she started teaching Tolkien the names of plants and trees very, very early on. And I wonder if perhaps this might not be something that we can all learn from, in the sense that she made these objects, these living animals and plants, real to Tolkien. Well, Hilary, Tolkien's brother, was born shortly after. He was a couple years younger than him. And suddenly, about that time after Hilary is born, Tolkien becomes quite ill. And it turns out that he has the South African climate is very, very bad for him. The doctors decide that he should go back to England, and so Mabel takes the two boys and goes back to England in hopes that the father will be able to follow them in short order. But I'm getting a little ahead. I should go back down to this last comment. It was when John, when Tolkien was still quite young, he decides to write his father a letter. He was 4 years old. So he was a very, very precocious kid. Already at the age of four, he knew how to read and write. And he was writing his father a letter. And he writes his father a letter which reads, which basically says that he misses him and he can't wait to see him. It was on February 14th, St. Valentine's Day. And we still have the letter. We still have the note that he wrote. Sadly, his father became ill with rheumatic fever and died. He died on February 15th, and his mother never actually sent the letter that he wrote to him, but that's how we still have it, probably. Well, this created a terrible situation for them, because right now, you have the Tolkien family. Mabel and the boys decide to settle in Birmingham near some relatives that are Anglican, they basically fall into poverty. They stay out of poverty because of some help of relatives, but the relatives really didn't help that much. And so when Mabel was really desperate, she had to turn to the church. She turned to the Anglican church, but didn't get much help. I find this really interesting because I also, I've done a lot of research on Charlie Chaplin's life, and about the same time, Chaplin was living in poverty in England as well, and his parents also didn't get much help from the church at that time. But in any case, Mabel decides, because of a few circumstances, she has a sister who gets a divorce from a man, and they both needed some help, and the Catholic Church was there for them, and so she converts to Catholicism. And basically what this means is that they're going to be, the church, Roman Catholic Church, is taking care of them. The local priests and others are taking care of them, but they're pretty much stuck with poverty. And Tolkien is quite poor at this time. So once Mabel converts to Catholicism, she realizes that she can't afford to live in Birmingham, which is a big industrial city, and also it's bad for Tolkien's health. Now, I wonder if this doesn't affect him a little bit, and he's thinking about living in the countryside, living a simple life, living closer to the land, because the Industrial Revolution is going on, things are really terrible in many cities, especially in Birmingham, so they move to a place called Sarehole. One of the things that Tolkien is able to do there is explore the countryside. I don't know how many of you were old enough or lived in a place where your parents would just let you run. How many of you had that growing up? And didn't you have a sense, those of you, when you were allowed to run? I mean, nowadays, with my kids, we never let them do that, right? You know, you just can't do that in this world. You just don't feel comfortable with that. But in my day, you know, everybody in the town of Odessa knew me, and they would have told on me if I was doing something naughty or, you know, starting a fire at somebody's house or something. But in this day, Tolkien talks about going and running into farmers' fields and stealing their corn, and they even called some, they even gave nicknames to some of these men, like the old ogre or the old gaffer, and some of these names start coming into Tolkien's stories later on, if you're familiar with them. So I'm going to take a quick excursus. So they're in this kind of idyllic kind of country area. Tolkien is having a blast with his brother. His brother later on will actually go on and have a occupation that deals more with agriculture and things, because he loved the land. And so there's this really interesting series of circumstances, I think, that help old Tolkien come to be a little bit more aware of the world around him. And so I'd like to do is just quick take an excursus. I think that there are eight things that really contribute to Tolkien being connected to the land in a way that, I don't know, maybe it's not quite normal for other kids. But one of them is certainly an exploration of nature. I have, this is a Gustav Dore illustration. Dore is an engraver, and I don't know if anybody knows him. Tolkien was completely enamored of Dore. And so you can see this is a painting of nature, and even art in this sense has a sense of luring me in, giving me a sense of wonder. But like I said, Tolkien and his brother are having a ball. They're running around in the countryside. They have a sense of freedom. His health is getting much better. He's recovering from some of the illnesses and things that he had, which were pretty serious. And Mabel continues to teach him the names of plants. And one of the things that you'll notice if you've ever read Tolkien is he knows a lot about plants, and all the plants in his fantasy novels are actual plants that he's borrowing from the real world, and he's putting them in there. And there's actually books written on Tolkien's interest in plants and things that he had. Besides being able to run around in nature, the other thing that Mabel did for him, which is really, I think, one of those wonderful things that parents can do, and that is that she just gave him good books to read. Again, another Dory illustration, this one from the Idylls of the King by Tennyson. This is Merlin with Vivian. And one of the things he started reading was Arthurian legends. And I always wondered, you know, his father's name was Arthur. And he starts reading about King Arthur and Guinevere. And if you know these stories, you know that they're pretty racy, right? You know, Lancelot has an affair with Guinevere, who's King Arthur's wife, and there's all these sorts of things. So there's a lot going on. But he also starts becoming fascinated, especially with Norse mythology. I'd be curious what he would think of the Avengers and Thor sort of things that are going on in the theaters these days. He loves Norse mythology, but also Greek mythology. But he was so precocious and he was so smart that once he started learning these myths, he wanted to learn and read them in the original languages. We know that he had a facility in 35 languages, and that he was fluent probably in about 15. But this comes very, very early on as he's reading these stories. So like I say, he's precocious, he's extremely bright little kid. And so he starts reading these great stories. And I think these stories encourage great imagination in him. Later on, he will become a translator of the great medieval stories like Beowulf, and then he'll start writing his own stories for his own kids. He's going to have four children, and he's going to start telling his own kids these various stories, and eventually all of those are made into books and a part of the Tolkien universe, even though they fit in that Tolkien, Hobbit, Lord of the Rings universe in some way, as you can see this medieval tale by Farmer Giles of Ham, who is about a kind of a hapless farmer. But notice his heroes are often farmers, they're often simple folk, they're people who live close to the land, and the villains are people, well, who live in big cities, who want to control and be people of power, and we'll talk a little more about that in a minute. I think the other thing that Mabel did for Tolkien was, of course, you know, his love of language. He, as I was pointing out, notice some of the lists. Greek and Latin, he was fluent in. Spanish, he learns from a priest who helps take in the folk Tolkien family. And when Tolkien found out that the priest could speak Spanish, he immediately had him teach him. He learns German. Finnish is interesting because he starts, this is a Finnish story, the Kalevala, and he learns this story and actually does a translation of it. He loves these ancient myths, these ancient stories from ancient cultures, and he thinks there's great truth in them. And he starts creating his own languages. He starts speculating. He starts wondering, what would English have been like if it had been before? And he knows now, he's starting to learn the rules, that like when German comes into English, Mutter becomes mother, right? And Vater is father. And you have these rules, and he starts speculating what the language must have been before. And then he starts creating elf languages and early languages of humans. One of them, the most famous one he calls is Quenya. But he basically has 15 dialects. He thinks about people living in different cities and learning about different dialects. And it's pretty amazing what he does. And he also his mother really encourages him in the arts. And this is one of Tolkien's own drawings. And he's a very, very good artist. He learns it, he develops it over time. And one of the things, I don't know about you, but when I look at this picture, when I look at the drawing, what I'm drawn to is, you know, it's all, he loves drawing trees. He knows trees intimately, he knows nature intimately, but it's like the roots. He knows the roots of trees. It's like this is really alive. And you can see the spider in the corner, the tarantula. They probably tried to bite him. Mushrooms, there's a real depth to a lot of his drawings, and I highly encourage you. And some of you got to see there's a traveling show, right? With Tolkien's art, and that was that New York?
New York, yeah.
And so if it comes to somewhere close to you, I think you'd really enjoy it. Anything you want to say about?
It was just a bunch of his hand-drawn maps of all of the areas and some of his early ideas, some of bullet
points. Like the early covers of his books before they got changed to whatever it was now.
Okay. Yeah, and we're going to find that his interest in maps comes up in just a little bit. We'll find out why that is. I just hit the screen wrong button. So, the other thing he does with his, despite being from the Tolkien Family Piano Company and being encouraged in the musical arts, it was something that he never could figure out. He was just not musical. And sadly, one of the things that he does say about that is he wishes he could be musical. He would like to have been musical, but sadly, here I'll give you a quote. "I have very little musical knowledge, though I come from an extremely musical family, owing to the defects of education and the opportunity that I had as being without a father. Such music as was in me was submerged until I finally was married, and I married a musician, and I married her because she was musician." We'll find out more about that. He's writing this later in life. But he says, "When I could think of music as if it was a language, then I could appreciate it even more." So he's coming at everything from language. "Music gives me great pleasure, sometimes inspiration, but I remain in a position where I'm unable to help people with my music. I'm not very talented with that." But one of the things I'd like you to notice is if down at the bottom, his later writings will inspire many, many people. There's large operas, there's symphonic works. Led Zeppelin said that their song Stairway to Heaven was based on Tolkien, and we'll see other musical influences later on. So despite the fact he didn't have much ability with music, he did influence a lot of music. Perhaps one of the most interesting things about his education is that he, when he was off at school, they developed a club called the TCBS. And it meant the tea club that met at the Barrows restaurant. And they would meet afterwards and they would talk about poetry. They would talk about stories. They would talk about art. They would talk about music. They would talk about creating those things. And these young kids started pushing each other. "Tolkien, you're really good at poetry. You should write more poetry. And your crazy languages, well, that's a little weird. But yeah, the other stuff, yeah, we got to do it." And they were all writers, and they were all fascinated in mythology, especially Norse mythology, and caught up in these stories. Christopher Weissman, Jeffrey Smith, just called GB usually, and Rob Gilson, and then there was Tolkien. And they would become hard and fast friends, and they would just sign their letters, member of the TCBS. And they were dear. And we'll find out a little bit more about them. And perhaps one of the greatest influences on Tolkien was Father Francis Morgan. And the reason Francis Morgan, he was a Catholic priest who had taught Tolkien in his educational as he was growing up. The reason he became so influential was that unfortunately for Tolkien, Tolkien's mother developed diabetes in a day where there was no insulin. And because she didn't have insulin, sadly, Mabel died very young. Tolkien was 12, she was 34. And so what that meant was what was going to happen to the boys. And in a move that's, I think, rather unusual, we certainly wouldn't see it happen today, Father Francis Moore became the guardian of the both boys. A priest became the father, of the father-father of the two boys. And he was, as this is one of Humphrey's kind of snide off the comment remarks, talking about Father Francis, well, he was not a terribly great intellect, but he was a man who was enormously kind, incredibly humorous, very flamboyant, and he deeply loved the boys. What's interesting about him is that he came from a very, very wealthy family. His money had made a his family had made a fortune in the sherry business. And because he had all this money, he was basically able to help raise the boys out of his own funds, that his family helped him. When Mabel died, she had 800 pounds to her name, which is what, $1,000, couple thousand dollars. And so the boys were completely destitute. And so for Father Francis Morgan takes him in. And of Tolkien writing about his own mother, says, "My dear mother was a martyr indeed. And it is not to everybody that God grants so easy a way to his great gifts as he did to my brother Hilary and myself, giving us a mother who would literally kill herself with labor and trouble so that she might ensure we would have the best life possible." He kind of fought, even later on, he wrote this when he was quite young, actually. He was in his early, not quite 20. And I think he perceived that she just had worked herself to death, but I think most people think it was just the fact that there was nothing like insulin for her. So Father Francis Morgan takes over, and it was actually quite a good thing. And Lewis becomes very, very well-read in Catholic Roman theology and Christianity, and especially loves Augustine. We will see that that comes through in some of his writings in a bit. So as they slowly went on, the TCBS became really important to them, but they all had to grow up. Tolkien, you can see here in the middle of his other friends, eventually wound up having to go off to school. It was, of course, around World War I, the time of World War I comes along, and all four of the young men would be taken off to France. And Tolkien and them would meet right before they went off to France. They tried to all get into the same unit, but they were basically split up. And they went in different directions. And as you can imagine, I've already been painting a picture of some rather difficult situations. We'll see that as they're getting ready and studying for war, that life will get harder for Tolkien. But there is a glimmer of hope, a moment of a twist of fate. When Tolkien was taken by Father Francis Morgan, an aunt of Tolkien's on the Suffield side took Tolkien and Hilary in. Father Francis was basically their father, but they were living with a great aunt who provided food, but he paid for it, and because she was in poverty and had lost her husband and things like that. But then she became unable to take care of the boys, so they were sent off to another boarding house close to where Father Francis could kind of help with them. And in that boarding house was a bunch of orphans. And one of those orphans was a woman by the name of Edith Pratt. Her mother had her out of wedlock. She never understood the story, but the Pratt family was also a deeply musical family. Their names were the Groves, and if you know the Groves musical dictionary, that was the family that she was from. She was Edith was in the same house as an orphan. She never knew her father. And her mother had taken her and also had died quite unexpectedly at a young age. And so she was left to go into this orphanage where Tolkien and Hilary were now at. Tolkien was 16, she was 19, and he fell head over heels in love with her. Well, this is his description of their first kiss. I recall my first kiss to you, my dear Edith, and your first kiss to me. As I recall, it was kind of an accident. And our good nights when sometimes, and I also remember our good nights when sometimes you and I would hang out the windows in our nightgowns and pajamas and talk absurdly long until the night, into the morning, and how we watched the sun come up through the mist and hear the bell toll the hour, and the moths almost used to frighten you away, and I would whistle call to you and we would go off on our bike rides together. And we would have talks. I remember that time with those three great kisses. I don't know what that meant, but it would have been fun to have known. Tolkien was, you can tell that he's completely enamored of it. And Tolkien is reading medieval chivalric literature. He's reading about King Arthur, he's reading about these other people, and he's acting like a medieval knight. Or at least he's trying to, as you can if you're 16 years old, because he doesn't know how to fall in love with anybody. So finally, they decide, you know, they're a little worried that this arrangement is going to get out, so they start leaving at different times during the day. He would go off on a bike, and she would go off on a bike, and they would agree to meet in a certain spot, and then eventually, of course, they get found out, and Father Francis is furious. Why is he furious? Partially because Tolkien's grades are suffering. He didn't make it into Oxford the first time he tried. He's so smitten by Edith that he's not studying. And he's just reading and he's writing elvish languages and making up stories and he's doing all this stuff and he can't get into Oxford. So Father Francis finds out about this and he forbids them to have any communication or any contact with each other. But they live in the same house and so he can't really stop it. I mean, Tolkien does what any good kid his age would have done. He tells Father Francis he won't talk to her again and then he just keeps doing what he did. And, you know, so eventually Father Francis catches them together at one point and he decides he moves them out of that house so that they can't be with each other. He forbids her to talk, he forbids Tolkien to talk to her. He's now 18 when this is all found out. He forbids them to talk until he turns 21. He's 18, she's already in her 20s. So with her gone, Tolkien actually makes it into Oxford, and here's a picture of him. He starts studying philology, the study of languages, which is right up his alley. He loves studying literature. And Edith Bratt, I think I had Pratt on the last one, it is Bratt, they have this 3 years apart. And Tolkien is writing her letters, sending her letters, but she's not necessarily getting them. And after a while, she thinks Tolkien has given up on her, and she falls in love with another young man and gets engaged. On his 21st birthday, Tolkien rushes to her house and says they should get engaged. And she's already engaged. So Tolkien doesn't know what to do. He's completely smitten by her. He decides, no, what we're going to do is let's spend some time together. So they spent the next few days talking, and at the end of the time, he must have been really convincing because she broke up the engagement with the other man, and they went off and they became engaged. And one of the dilemmas that Tolkien had with this was that she was a very gifted musician, as I pointed out earlier. She is playing organ for the local Anglican church. She's a concert pianist performer. She has those sorts of abilities, but she is having to make a living, so she makes money teaching piano lessons and things like that. So she doesn't really have time to kind of follow her own sorts of hopes and dreams. But Tolkien eventually is able to talk her into allowing them to be engaged. But they don't tell Father Francis, because he doesn't even know that they're seeing each other again. And they're not sure that Tolkien's worried he's going to get in the way of this relationship. And so they decide that they'll set up the entire marriage And one barrier was Tolkien's deep, passionate love for the Catholic Church. And he asked Edith to become Roman Catholic. She's very deeply committed to the Anglican Church and has a lot of roots there, but she loves Tolkien, and so she decides to do that. But about that time, Tolkien is also, as a cadet, now going to have to start thinking about the war. And this gets us back to the problem of the TCBS, and where I kind of left that off a little bit ago. Tolkien decides, let's get engaged. I want to go off. I want to. He wants to be married to her. And then he's also getting ready to go off to World War I, and he's trying to think, can we get married before we go? Which will happen a lot of young men and women got married, and it's called The Lost Generation. It's a fabulous movie by Peter Jackson, who did the Lord of the Rings movies, called this one out of my head. It's you can see it on like Amazon Prime now. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? They Who Will... What is it?
They Who Shall Never Grow Old.
They Who Shall Never Grow Old, the generation that went to war. And yeah, thank you. It's a really great... it's interesting. Peter Jackson, who made Lord of the Rings, also did this World War I thing. And this, most of the people that went off to France did not come back. And so many of them got married, and then, you know, there were all these widows in England at this time. And... Tolkien is still writing his poetry. His friends are encouraging him to write. They are encouraged. They want, not only are they also are doing their own writing. They're all seeing themselves as kind of a group that's kind of moving together through the war. And there's tons of nature themes that come up in his poetry. Lo, young we are, and yet have stood like planted hearts in the great sun of love, so long as two fair trees in woodland or in open dale stand utterly entwined and breathe the airs and suck the very light together, that we have become as one deep-rooted in the soil of life and tangled in sweet growth. And he's writing this while he's in World War I. He's writing these sorts of poems, and he's often, when he goes off to the war, he joins the Lancashire Fusiliers, and which means that these guys with these muskets, and he joins them. And as he's going off to war, he doesn't really know if he's going to make it. So he's pretty smart. And remember, I told you, yes, you saw the maps and things that he drew. Tolkien decides what area should he go into that would give him the greatest chance of survival. He decides to become a signaler, you know, the guy who signals with flags and things. I think I have a picture of that. He decides to become a signaler, and he decides to make maps. And he thinks that he's drawing maps and doing cartography, and he's really kind of a little bit out of the main fray of things. Just to go back, Edith and him finally are wed right before he can go off. They tell Father Francis just a few days before they're going to be wed. He says he would do the wedding. They said, we already lined somebody else up because we thought you weren't going to let us get married. So they get married. Father Francis is there, and he will actually do the baptisms of their kids later on. This is from the new movie Tolkien, which is out in theaters. I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard that it's pretty good. However, the Tolkien family has disavowed it. They said, nobody talked to us about it. Nobody allowed, you know, they can make a movie but whatever they want. And so they've kind of distanced themselves from it. The interesting thing about what I've read about in reviews is that it focuses on their romance that they have, but it doesn't focus on the influences of religion or a lot of other things like that. So it's more of a romantic movie, so that works okay. But it's a little bit disingenuous. Well, so Tolkien's off in World War I, and the Battle of Somme comes along, and this creates a real interesting tragic event in Tolkien's life. Basically, what happens is he gets a letter from one of the TCBS, they're all in the war together, and G.B. Smith, Jeffrey Smith, of the TCBS, is wounded. And he writes, GBS writes to Tolkien when he has, while he's wounded, and this is his letter. "My dear Tollers," let me think, "my chief consolation is that if I am scuppered," it's a boating term, right? If I'm sunk, you know, if a boat sinks. "If I am scuppered tonight when I go out on military maneuvers, there will be still at least you and the TBS to give voice to the dreams that we've had together and what we all have agreed upon. For the death of one of its members cannot, I am determined, dissolve the DCBS. Death can make us loathsome and helpless as individuals, but it cannot put an end to those of us that are immortal together. And I write to you, please tell Christopher," one of the other TBS, "that send this letter on to him. May God bless you, my dear John Ronald, and may you say the things that I have tried to say in my life after I am not there, for I'm sure this will be my lot. Yours, GDS." And he died in the battle right after that letter. Not only would that be difficult, and Tolkien would write Edith in a letter, and he said, "My dear Edith, you would not believe what I see. Trees without leaves, landscape without grass. It is a desolate life. Junior officers are being killed off, dozens by the minute. Parting from all the ones they love. This is death. I see death." And then after GBS died, one of their other friends also would die. G.D. Gordon. And so two of the three TBS, two of the four TBS, TCBS friends would be dead within a very short time. Tolkien probably would have died too, except for the fact that he got trench fever. And so he gets put into hospital, and he starts what he calls his mad hobby. He starts working on this mythology. He starts creating the story of the Lord of the Rings. He starts developing it. It's already been there, it's already been cooking, but he's now working at it really passionately. And we can see the beginnings of his ideas of the Lord of the Rings, but not yet the Hobbit. And it's because of this illness he's able to go home and he's able to recover in England. This is another photo from the movie Tolkien. This is Edith dancing in the woods. And one day, Tolkien, he was home long enough, so she became pregnant and they had a child, their oldest son. And they were out on a picnic one day and she started to sing, and she was incredible, had an incredible voice, and started dancing. And Tolkien was so moved by the event that he wrote an entire myth called The Story of Beren and Lúthien. If you don't know it, you probably do if you've seen the story of The Lord of the Rings, because it's basically the story of Aragorn and, I'm drawing a blank, help me out with the name.
Arwen.
Oh, thank you, yes. I had another name in my head, and that wasn't it yet. So it had Arwen, and so the story is a very simple one. Beren, the young man, falls in love with Lúthien. Lúthien is an elf. In Tolkien's mythology, he starts out talking about fairies, but he thinks that's not a very mythic word, so he changes it to elves. And for him in his mythology, the idea is that the world and nature still has the potential for good. God created the world good, and there's all these creatures out there. And elves are unfallen humans. So they're immortals. They can die, they can be killed, but they are immortal. If nothing happens to them, they can live forever. They don't have the corruption of sin in them. So that's what elves are. So Beren falls in love with Lúthien, who's an elf, who's immortal, but he's a man and he's going to die. He's been told that he, by Fingal, who is the elf king, that he must perform this great feat in order to marry his daughter, because he's a man, and why should he be able to marry this elvish queen? And he performs this. Basically, if you know the story, he takes one of the jewels, takes the jewels of the Silmarillion from the crown of Morgoth, and brings it back, and he's able to marry Luthien. Luthien decides in the story that she's so in love with Beren that she will give up her immortality because she can't bear living without him because of that love that they have. She would rather live a mortal life and die with him than to live an immortal life without him. It's a very interesting, very beautiful, heartrending story, and it comes from this sort of an event. And we'll see, remember those names, Beren and Luthien, we'll talk a little bit more about them. So Tolkien now comes back, and the war is over. He's lucky that he survived. He's sunk back a few times, but each time he gets sick again, so he's lucky, right? He survives the war. There's going to be lots of parallels if you want to. If you come to the C.S. Lewis lectures, Lewis also survives the war because he's ill through the war. He comes back and he needs a job. He's desperate. And he goes to Oxford where he hopes he can continue kind of finishing up his studies and things. And while he's doing that, he gets a job at the Oxford English Dictionary. And they're on the W's by the time he gets there. And so he writes the entries for warm, wasp, water, and winter. So if you want to read Tolkien's writings in the Oxford Dictionary, there they are. And he was absolutely fascinated with words, the history of words and how far back they go. And he actually becomes a consultant on the Jerusalem Bible later on, and he actually does the translation for the book of Job. I don't know how I got Job here. It should be Jonah. He does the book of Jonah, the shorter chapters. And so I probably wrote that late at night, but I'm kind of like Tolkien. I get it. You know, he stays up really late reading and writing and can't stop. And then, you know, that's what Tolkien's life was like. He did that a lot. Eventually, he becomes a professor. He starts teaching at Oxford. He had a little bit of a stint where he went to Leeds University. And while he was at Leeds, he decided to start a club. Now, the TCBS is decimated. Christopher Weissman survives. He's Methodist. He becomes a schoolmaster in England, and Tolkien and him don't really see each other after this. So Tolkien has lost the TCBS. He's lost these friends. But he really wants to keep their memory alive. And so he starts a club called the Viking Club at Leeds. And he said there's two things that you had to do. You had to be passionate about literature and music and the arts and myth and talk stories and argue and be able to read each other's works and do all that. And you had to drink copious amounts of beer. And those two kind of helped each other in the process. He starts that, and then he gets hired away back to Oxford, where he had gone to school. And it was actually kind of a close... It was kind of close on him becoming the professor. It was an older candidate who had a lot more experience. He was a much more well-known scholar. Tolkien was kind of up and coming, and it was a divided vote. And the president of the college had to make the choice. I'm pretty sure he chose Tolkien because he cost less. Just my guess. I don't know. Nobody's ever really said that. So Tolkien settles into a rather... ordinary life. This is Carpenter's description of Tolkien's life after he becomes a professor. So after this, you might say nothing else happened. Tolkien came to Oxford, was a professor of Anglo-Saxon literature for 20 years, was then elected Merton Professor of English Language and Literature. He went to live a conventional Oxford suburb, out in the country, so he could raise a garden and enjoy his trees, where he spent the first part of his retirement, moved to a nondescript seaside resort, came back to Oxford, and had an unremarkable life. Most people would say it was the most boring thing on earth. He was exceptionally ordinary. Except for the fact that he would write probably the most popular novel or fantasy novel or story for the 20th century. Tolkien, Tom Shippey's book, Author of the Century, makes the argument that Tolkien's fantasy novel is in more countries and in more copies than any other novel that was written in the 20th century. The only person that comes close to rivaling him is C.S. Lewis. And both of them were doing the same thing. And it's really interesting that here you have this academic who studies languages, who's writing, giving lectures, and by the way, he was incredibly passionate. He was very good at what he did, but he mumbled and spoke very fast and nobody could understand. I tried to imitate him. And so when you listen, there are radio broadcasts of him. He actually got a tape recorder when they came out, and he loved listening to his voice. And if you ever listen to any of those, you just go, what? I can't understand a word of what he says. So C.S. Lewis would make him a character in some of his stories and would play off of that, kind of making fun of him a little bit. Well, so Tolkien is, he leads a rather ordinary life, but he's really interested, and notice this is a picture from a drawing from early 20th century Birmingham, and what some of the Industrial Revolution is doing to the countryside. Tolkien tells a story of going back to his hometown, to Saerholt, to see how he wanted to go back and see his childhood home, and he said he got lost because he couldn't find his way in the streets. He was absolutely horrified at what industrialization, the car, and mechanization was doing to the country. And so one of the dilemmas was that Tolkien is now in a place where he's lecturing, but he's really frustrated. He wants what he calls the wildlife. And what he means by that, he thinks we have to preserve trees, we need to preserve parks, we need to preserve unmechanized farmlands, we need to preserve all of these sorts of things, and he's like a voice crying in the wilderness. Everybody else is saying, this is technology. Tolkien had a car from 1932 to 1940, which he hardly ever drove, and the war broke out. He said, why does everybody have cars? You just have to build roads, and you have to cut down trees, and you have to cut down forests to do these things. He sold his car and never had a car again. He was just very, very frustrated with the world around him. Edith... they wound up having four children. Edith would, why don't we stand real quick? We've been sitting for an hour. Let's just stand. These chairs are, I was sitting earlier. I really enjoyed the lectures, but my butt was not so good. Embodiment, right? Yeah. So I'll just say a few things about Edith. Edith was, did not take to social life in Oxford very well. She was an orphan, and one of the things that I forgot to mention is when they were married, when Edith had to sign the wedding license, Edith did not know the name of her father. Brat was her name, and her mother never talked about the fact, we don't know what happened, whether she had a love affair or something other than that, but she didn't know it, so she put down her uncle's name, and of course that caused that was not the thing to do. But so she had to eventually admit that no, it wasn't my uncle who got my mom pregnant, and so she admitted this to Tolkien and said, "Listen, I have some secrets, and these are something you know." And he said, "It matters not. It matters not." He loved her so dearly. But when she got to Oxford, she, being an orphan, being a person that was kind of out of that social life, people at Oxford were mostly lords, people who were from great wealth and money and those sorts of things. And Edith was used to poverty, and she didn't know how to fit in with these other wives. She didn't know how to fit into the environment. She was extremely lonely and depressed. Tolkien says that about his own spiritual life, he said that he was often took great bouts of depression throughout his life, partially because of his early loss of his mother. And his loss of his mother, while he was kind of in a place where he identified his mother with the countryside, with trees and forests, and being able to enjoy and appreciate those sorts of things. Edith became so depressed, she said, I have to do something. She wasn't sure what, but she eventually decides that the thing that she has to do is get involved in the church. And once she starts doing that, she started feeling like she had a little bit better of a situation. It was about this time that Tolkien decides that he is going to start another club, like the Viking Club, in Oxford. And he decides that he's going to start a club called the Kolbiters. It's actually an ancient Norwegian term called the Kolbiters. Kolbiter is somebody who sits around a fire and listens to stories and is so close to the fire that they're biting the coals. And so a Kolbiter is somebody who listens to stories. And the Kolbiters were a group of people, scholars, writers, authors, and they were some really brilliant people, came together over at a pub called the Eagle and the Child, which they nicknamed the Bird and the Baby. And they would meet there and drink Guinness, and then every Tuesday night have a lazy evening, talk well into the hours, and talk about things that they read. Tolkien read almost all of his Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit there to that group. C.S. Lewis read all of the Chronicles of Narnia in that group, and they read to each other and they would give each other criticisms. Tolkien was notorious for being an incredibly perfectionist personality. And if somebody gave him a criticism about something, this is how he would react. So if you were talking about The Return of the King, the fourth novel, and you'd say, I think you should fix this. He'd say, okay, and he'd go back to the first one and start writing all over. So it was like the way he wrote was like waves coming on a seashore. It kept going back to the beginning and fixing everything. So if you read The Lord of the Rings, they're remarkably consistent. They're brilliant in their storytelling and in their abilities. And Lewis would dash out something. I'm not even sure he edited it, reread it. He'd just send them off because they were selling like hotcakes. And the things they were, but they became, the thing about Lewis and Tolkien is they became incredibly close friends. And the one thing that Tolkien, I would like to read to you about Tolkien, he says, "The only unpayable debt I have in my life I owe to C.S. Lewis. Had it not been for his influence, had it not been for his sheer encouragement, had not been for his friendship, my novels would never have been written." Wow. He never believed that his stories were anything other than a myth that he was kind of writing for himself. And when he wrote The Hobbit and it finally was published, it was sold out within months. And the publishers thought, whoa, we've got this thing, give us hobbits, we want more hobbits. And so they immediately wanted Tolkien to write the next novel, and he says, okay, I'll have it for you in a year, and it took him about 20 to get, he had them all three written, they were all three done by the time he gave him the next ones, but it was just the way he wrote, he just was so perfectionist. It was really true that Lewis was really important to him. They started calling themselves the Inklings, which is a nice little play on words, because they write in ink, but they also like to give each other hard times. Well, I would like to talk a little bit about the idea about myth. One of the things Tolkien said is, so here's this guy who starts learning languages at a very, very early age. He starts creating these myths, and he basically, when he creates these languages, these elven languages, he decides that there must be a story behind these words. How are these words used? And so the story comes out of the languages, not the languages are created for the story. And I think he's created an impossible task for anybody else who wants to be a fantasy writer. Because they're so consistent and they're so well integrated. Tolkien wrote this, "They, the stories, the myths, arose in my mind as a given things, or as given things. And as they came separately, so too the links grew. And absorbing, although continually interrupted labor, especially even apart from the necessities of life. Since the mind would wing to the other pole and spread itself on the linguistics." Notice he's always going back to the language. "Yet always I had a sense of recording what was already there. Somewhere or not, somewhere not of, it, of inventing." He had some practice. He wrote Father Christmas letters to his kids. Every year it was Christmas, he would send a letter from Father Christmas or Santa Claus to his kids, and this is his art, and he would draw art, and he had stories about polar bears and things like that at the North Pole. But how The Hobbit came about, is a rather odd story. Tolkien says, I was grading papers and was mercifully bored. And one of the candidates had mercifully left one of the pages with nothing on it. Which is the best thing possible if you're an examiner, because then you don't have to read it. But then I wrote on one page, in a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. I thought. Names always generate a story in my mind. I thought, I better find out what a hobbit is. And that is the beginning. So he just writes it into a book, and then he has to figure out, and then he finds out that, you know, he starts creating a mythology about the word hobbit and where it comes from and all those sorts of things. And when it sold out so quickly, one of the things that he said, when he was describing the hobbits to Humphrey Carpenter in his on an interview, he said, hobbits are just rustic English people made small in size because it reflects generally small reach of their imaginations. Tolkien really thought that it was imagination that would save the world. That our great crisis in our modern era is a lack of imagination to see solutions to problems. If you have an industrial revolution, or if you're cutting down trees, or if you're doing those sorts of things, what is the problem you have? You have a lack of an imagination. And that was the problem with the Brits. And the hobbits are a little like that. Not the small reach of their courage, however, or their latent power. So the hobbits are like representatives of people, but they have great courage, and they have power. They just don't know it, and they just don't use it. And when they do great things, like the story we just saw. Well, Tolkien in 1937, after he published The Hobbit, decides that he wants to explain what fairy stories are, and he realizes that nobody's really ever talked about this. And he basically realizes, he says, I think that the imagination is the solution to the problems that we have in England. The problems that we have with industrialization and those sorts of things. And that we maybe can use stories as a means to help people see that there's something true. So what is fairy? Fairy is a land, in Celtic mythology, where Tolkien is getting a lot of this, the Celts had this idea that there were places in the world that were thin places. Places where you feel that there's something more to life than just living and breathing and eating. And I'm going to use Holden as an example of that, right? Why do we come to Holden? It feels to me, when I come here, like a thin place. I can leave my phone for the most part, right? I can leave whatever sorts of things are drawing me back into the world that keep me from having my imagination so that I can do the things that I need to do to be the person I want to be. Celtic ideas about fairy was that there are these thin places where the people from one land, the fairies, can come into the other land. And the other thing that's true about that is that it creates what I call thick time. Have you ever felt like you go to Holden and you're here for a few days, because you've left all that other stuff, it feels like a really long time? I take students to Europe all the time, and when I'm there for like 2 or 3 days, I sit them down and I say, I want you to imagine, we work really hard at trying to get the students to put their phones away because it's expensive, and just experience the culture and try to learn the languages. And I say, after like 3 days, I say, how long have you been here? Just how long does it feel? And they say, months. I feel like I've been here a month. Why? It's because we've gone to another place where you're the other, where the languages are different, where you have to struggle to understand and be a part of it, and you see remarkable beauty that you've never seen where you've lived before. It's a thin place. It creates thick time. And Tolkien thought that's what mythology should do. That's what stories should do. They should be, these aren't just children's stories. These are stories that help the imagination. He borrows this idea from Coleridge, really. It's a reality that he says is, he calls it arresting strangeness. It's like going to another country, you know, where you've never been before, and it's just strange. Fantasy is another land you can go to. And Coleridge said, the primary function of the imagination is for the human ability to learn from creation about the creator. Right? We add symbols. Trees aren't just trees. They have names. And in Tolkien's mythology, and in his story, one of the great characters of his mythology was the ants and Treebeard, who is the oldest living being in the story. Maybe Tom Bombadil's older, there's a debate. But Treebeard is the oldest living being. He's a creature. Trees are the oldest living creatures. We should respect them. A lady across the street from him was trimming her trees, and Tolkien went out and berated her. And she says, well, it's blocking the sun from coming in my windows. And he says, it's supposed to. It's a wild tree. Let the tree be wild. And he was just beside himself. He couldn't stand people. Let trees be what they are. But the secondary function of imagination is for people to create, to become sub-creators. Tolkien said our greatest thing that we can do is tell stories. Stories that move us to be different people. Stories that move us to be compassionate and kind to the neighbor, to be courageous in the face of great evil, to love creation like the elves in his stories that love Lothlorien, the great forests that they lived in, how much they loved those trees. And nature can have its own sort of danger, but this point is that I'm going to skip the true lies point the idea is that fantasy is supposed to reveal the truth in our world that we cannot see and cannot feel or understand. So, for example, when I read stories to my grandchildren, and I read stories about, let's say I read the Lord of the Rings, and there's a scene in the Lord of the Rings where Frodo, who is the ring bearer, the evil ring, he has to drop it into the crack of doom to destroy it. And there's a scene where Frodo gets to the mountain, and his friend, Sam Gamgee, who's really kind of the hero of the whole story, right? If you know the story, Sam is the real hero. And what is he? He's a gardener. He's the main character and hero of the whole story. He's a little gardener. He's the guy that's going to save the world. And how does he do it? He does it through friendship. He says, well, Mr. Frodo, you can't walk up there, but I'll carry you. He picks him up. And he carries them. Now, what does that story do? It teaches my grandkids to have courage, to do the right thing, even though they may not ever have that opportunity in their own life. Maybe they need it in a different setting, in a conference room when somebody's offering some stupid idea, and the courage to stand up, right? That courage that they can learn from that story, from that mythology, can be something that they can borrow later. Dorothy is a simple farm girl, right? She goes to Oz and, you know, she saves the day. We learn from Dorothy. We learn from Frodo. We learn from Sam. And that's what he thought. These teach us truth. They expose evil for what it is. Fanny is not just for children or escapists, but it's about a good ending. A eucatastrophe is what he calls it. Tolkien says, all fantasy is about exposing the evil in the world, and if you go and read The Lord of the Rings, and I'll talk more about this on the third lecture, one of the main evil wizards is a guy who's cutting down the forests to create an industrial complex for weaponry so that he can take over. This is his villains, right? And it looks like the evil lord, Sauron, is going to win in the end. But victory is snatched because truth, for Tolkien, will always have to win out. You trust in it for Tolkien because it's the hope that we have. Sometimes we may not see it. Tolkien says sometimes all that we have is the ability to put up a good fight. We may not win that fight, but at least we can die with courage and chivalric compassion for the people around us. We die for the people we love. We die for the creation we love. We die for the hope of love that God gives us for the world. One of the stories Tolkien tells, he writes It's the only thing that's close to an allegory that he writes. He tells the story of an artist who decides he wants to draw a tree. Notice all the tree imagery that Tolkien has. It's an artist who wants to draw a tree. He just wants to draw a forest, one tree where the leaves are so real and the tree is so real that you can't tell the difference between the tree and the piece of art. Now, his name is Niggle, and he niggles. He worries over every little part of the tree. And he's got a neighbor whose name is Parrish, and he's lame, and he always needs help. And Parrish will come over and say, you know, Niggle, I need your help to fix my door. And Niggle will go, okay, and then he'll, I can't work on my tree, but I'll go and do it anyway because it's the right thing to do. I need to help my neighbor. And he can't ever quite get his work done. And he's working on this gigantic painting. And it turns out that eventually the house inspector comes by and says, Niggle, your roof is going to collapse. Your roof is not in very good shape. You should fix that. And Niggle says, yeah, but I've got to go on this journey. And if I go on this journey, I need to, you know, something that he promised to do. He goes on this journey. He's going to come back and then finish this tree, finish his masterpiece. So he goes away. While he's away, the roof falls in. The rain comes in. It destroys the painting except for one leaf, which is painted perfectly. And somebody, an artist finds it and they put it in a museum. And they leave it there. And then Niggle comes back and he finds Parrish. And he sees that his leaf is in the museum, but he realizes that his whole work is lost. And then Parrish is a gardener. He says, but look, have you seen this tree out here? And they go out and it's the real tree. And they go work the garden. And then one day, Niggle says, hey, you remember those mountains I painted? I have to go. It's time for me to leave. I need to paint that painting. Well, it's a story about Tolkien. I'm going to get to the end of his life. Tolkien, this is another artist representation of the Niggle representation. Notice that it takes for a very, very long time for the Lord of the Rings to come out. Tolkien had four children. One of his children, Christopher, is still alive. He's in his 90s, and he's still publishing Tolkien's papers. Tolkien has had many fans. John Lennon, Pope Francis, Isaac Asimov over in the corner. Prince Charles, Stephen Colbert, is a real big fan. Barack Obama could quote from Lord of the Rings regularly. Well, Edith and Tolkien settle down into a rather peaceful life. Eventually, they would retire to the countryside, in part because Tolkien has become so famous now that he wants to get away from the fans, because they're breaking into his house, stealing his stuff, because they want Tolkien's ashtray or something, you know. And so they decide to move to the countryside. One of the ironic things is that when Tolkien wanted to finally publish The Lord of the Rings, all publishers became a little bit skittish. It was really, really long. They didn't really want it. There was a paper shortage. And so they made a deal with Tolkien. They said, listen, we're not going to pay you a flat fee for these books. We're going to give you a percentage of every book that you sell. And he became fabulously wealthy. I mean, if he had taken the first deal, he would have just got a few thousand pounds. But no, now he has, in perpetuity, zillions of dollars. So he became incredibly wealthy, but his lifestyle never changed. He kept wearing the same clothes, and they moved to the countryside. Tolkien had what he called a heartfelt loathing for Disney. And Disney had approached him with the idea of making The Lord of the Rings into a movie. Not only did Disney approach him, but the Beatles approached him. Paul said he wanted to play Frodo. John thought he'd be a good Gollum. Ringo was Sam, and George would be Gandalf, and they wanted Stanley Kubrick to direct. They actually approached Stanley Kubrick and thought if Kubrick could convince Tolkien, that would be a really great thing. Kubrick said no. But the movement of Tolkien's writings kind of got started rolling beyond itself. You might remember some of these buttons, those of you who are old enough to remember these buttons. Frodo lives, help feed my hobbit. Frodo gave his finger for you. Some of those great things. Edith eventually would die. And notice that this is the tomb of Tolkien and Edith. Remember the story of Beren and Luthien? He put John Ronald Reuel, Tolkien, Beren, and Edith May, Tolkien, Luthien. So he takes the mythological story and puts it together. Tolkien was nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature by C.S. Lewis in 1961. He had been nominated before by others, so he had the right to nominate. And Tolkien is constantly seen with images of trees. I'll make a bigger point about this in my next lectures. Today, my goal was just to talk about more about his life. But notice, these are the last pictures of Tolkien's life. Oops, I got that in there, guys. This was his favorite tree. It's a black pine in Oxford Botanical Gardens, and that is the last photo that anybody took of him. He died a few days after this photo was taken. Tolkien has become wildly popular in the modern world with Peter Jackson's films in the early 2000s. The new books that Christopher keeps coming out with all the writings of his father. This is Edith Bratt, his daughter. Priscilla Tolkien, and that's his. He only had one daughter, and there's some of his art is being sold around. Amazon recently announced that they're going to remake all of the Lord of the Rings on Amazon Prime. It's going to be a major, many seasons, kind of Lord of the Game of Thrones sort of thing. And there's all sorts of online gaming. The Tolkien industry is something I think Tolkien would hardly understand or even know. This is the quote I started with. All that is gold does not, whoops. Yeah, all that is gold does not glitter. Not all that those who wander are lost. I think that line for Tolkien was about himself. His colleagues at Oxford criticized him for not doing more publishing of scholarly works. He published a lot of scholarly works, one of the great scholars of medieval Anglo-Saxon. And yet, when Tolkien finally finished The Lord of the Rings, some of his colleagues snidely said, "Now we know what you're doing all those years." But I bet they wish they had done something similar to that. Tolkien died at home after Edith had died. He was very depressed, started becoming forgetful. He started working on his works, and fortunately somebody like Humphrey Carpenter came and gave him, started working on his biography. I just want to close with a quote from C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis died in 1963. Tolkien died in 1973. But C.S. Lewis wrote Tolkien's obituary. And he died 10 years before Tolkien. He wrote an obituary for Tolkien because Tolkien had asked him to, and Lewis asked him to write an obituary, but Tolkien was too broken up by Lewis's death, so he never did. But he wrote, he said, of all the books that I've ever read, Tolkien's books are the most original. We cannot make any final judgment on them at this time. What we do know is that once we have read them, we will never be the same. And perhaps, if we are lucky, the world will not be either. It's, for me, a very personal kind of journey, thanks to Tolkien and Mrs. Noor and others, that kind of led me on an individual level to be the person that I am today and have me stand here before you. But I hope that if you are inspired to read like The Hobbit or some of Tolkien's works, you'll be able to see some of the important elements that he talks about for his love of God, love of nature, and a love of neighbor, and that he thinks that is the solution to the problems of the world. It is, as Tolkien once said, it is not great power that will solve the world's problems. it is simple acts of kindness that happen one day at a time, one place at a time, that will save our world. We have no other hope. And so I leave you with that thought.